Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this episode. I am excited to have with me Dawn Long. And for those of you that actually jump off and listen to me when I do interviews on other people's shows, you probably have seen Dawn's name come up because I have been on, she's done a podcast that's actually rebranded and reformed itself into a new and different version. And I got to be on the first version and the second version. In fact, the most recent episode, you guys might be listening to this sometime in October. And so this episode that I was on with her published in early August. And in that conversation that Dawn and I had there, we were talking a lot about trauma, but specifically what happens as a parent and the responsibility and the accountability that, you know, some of us are forced to reconcile with and take on ourselves. Because as I've said on other interviews and with other guests, you know, I feel like pretty strongly that once we know what is going on and the work that we have to do, I do feel like as a parent, we have an obligation to try and try hard. And because if we know all the truth and the evidence and yet we don't make any changes, I mean, that's just, it's a disservice to our children and we're robbing them of some opportunities. And what we try, we don't have to be perfect at. We don't have to nail it. I don't do that. I don't nail anything every day. but having a heartfelt, compassionate attempt to be able to right the wrongs and to learn what we didn't know and make those improvements, I think is really important. And I know from talking with Dawn, what connected for me and the reason why I've brought her onto the show for you guys to listen to her is she's got one of those broken mom stories. You know, one of those pasts that, you know, came up and got in the way of being the best mom she could. And so she's going to tell us a bit about that. And, you know, what I like about her experience too, is after learning all that, she's figured out a way to be able to give it back to other people. And so welcome to the show today, Dawn.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, you're right. I was one broken mom. And I think some days I still am. it's a process. And oh, where do I even start? Let's actually start at the beginning. I have this little story that I like to tell people. Is I grew up in a small little town called Mechanville, North Carolina, that used to be called Christmastown, USA. The best town that you could ever be in to grow up as a little girl, to hear the Christmas carols, to see the Christmas lights. But what was deep down behind all of that joy in those Christmas lights was a childhood that no child should ever have to be raised in. And I'm going to just dive right into it because those are the things that we really need to talk about. And I was abused as a child, and it wasn't just the mental abuse. It was the sexual abuse too as well. And when you're in that as a child, you think that's normal because you don't know any better. You don't know that that's not how things don't work in a family. And thank goodness I had a strong family as far as my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles that were to surround and support me. And they didn't even know this was going on. And that is what started this journey of my youngest son being in prison, because I didn't know how to break that pattern. And because of that pattern, my two younger sons were both sexually molested by a 12-year-old neighborhood boy. And all I wanted to do, and I found out on my youngest son's 8th birthday party. Ugh. A time to find out, if any. And when you find that out, you're devastated as a parent. And that was when I really realized I thought I was raising my kids right. And I was in some respects. But at the end of the day, they didn't know about the abuse that I had went through. And because they didn't know, they didn't know the signs. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward, we got them counseling like we were supposed to, did the things, went to go get it prosecuted. And because he didn't, well, actually neither one of them wanted to talk to the prosecutor, he wouldn't do anything. I didn't want that 12-year-old boy prosecuted. I wanted him to get help, because at 12 years old, who taught him that? Somebody taught him that at 12 years old. My heart was breaking for him and his mom, because she is on the receiving end of this too. And then fast forward, we thought everything was going okay. He was doing what I call the normal teenage things. He was drinking, smoking pot, skipping school. And I was going like, all right, kid, you know, we got to figure this out. And he went and talked to me or his dad. And then fast forward, you know, I took them out of school and I started homeschooling them, because I was going like, well, maybe this will help. And it did in some respects, but he was struggling with a lot of nightmares and a lot of things going on that led him to downloading child pornography. That's what he's in prison for. He's being held accountable for his actions. But you want to talk about somebody hitting their knees. When I came home from work, my house was completely and utterly freaking destroyed, because they had came in. And when they come in your house, they literally will destroy everything.
They toss it. Yeah.
Yeah, they toss it. And boy, did they toss it. And to walk into that, and here I was thinking, you know, he got arrested for pot because he was smoking pot. And to find that out, I was literally, first, my reaction is I was extremely angry. And then I realized, holy crap, we didn't do our boys the right thing, because he didn't know how to talk to us. He didn't know how to talk to us about the nightmares he was having. He didn't know how to tell us, Mom, this still is going on inside my head. He didn't know how to say that. So when that happened, of course, what a lot of people don't tell you is when you are a mom of a son or daughter in prison, you go through grief. It's like your kid just died, literally. And to me, he did, because I really had thought I had lost him literally forever. And to go through that process, and then I realized, hey, wait a minute, there's got to be other moms like me out here. And it took me over a year to find that group of moms, because we're really silent when it comes to our kids being in prison. And then they're really, really silent when it comes to their kids being in prison for child pornography or sex offenses. And to break that barrier and to realize that these moms didn't have the tools to get out of the quagmire, the depression, the anxiety, the sleepless nights that all of this causes. And I was going like, well, I figured out how to do that. And they were going like, well, how did you figure it out? And I think a lot of it is, for me personally, I learned how to deal with my emotions as I got older. And I learned how to, and I know a lot of people, and we talked about this, about forgiving. And for each person, that is different on their level. It's different how you look at things. And for me, I had to learn how to let go of the person that abused me. And let that shadow go. And that's what I call it. I actually call it shadow work to an extent. And then I had to learn how to let go of the 4-year-old Dawn, to let her know that this is not your fault. You didn't ask for this. And then I had to tell my son the same thing. I had to tell him, yes, your actions have consequences, but what you're experiencing is not your fault. I had to take accountability to let him know, I should have talked to you sooner. I should have let you know on whatever level an 8-year-old should know about what their parents go through. And we don't have to give them the gory details, but we should let our kids know that out in this world, even the kids that they play with, maybe you can't trust them nearly as much. And show them the signs of what goes on and let them know, hey, if something is not right, please talk to us. And if you don't want to talk to your parents, find somebody to talk to. I think that was the biggest thing that he's learned since he's been in there. And he actually is going through his program right now. And it's really helping us because we can actually call, and it's actually recommended that we can call and check on him. And it's not very often that you get that from a correctional facility to say, hey, you can call and check on your child. And yes, he's an adult. He's actually 24, 25. He hears this, forgive me if I forget your age. Having three boys, you forget at some point or another. And through this whole journey, I really started talking to my second son. And I was asking him, I said, what are some of the struggles that you're having? I said, because I don't want to see you in that same situation as your brother, because it was both of them. And he's going like, he started learning how to do clearing work, meditation work. And I think that's what my middle son actually inspired me to really start looking at, what can I do for moms and what can I do to help them? Because I needed somebody to help me and I didn't have anybody. Mm-hmm. And I want them to have somebody, and that somebody is me. Mm-hmm. Now, I want them to understand that when you come into it, it is not no shame whatsoever. Because we do as good as we think we can when we're parents. And I want you to understand, as a mom or as a dad or as a grandparent, because a lot of grandparents are raising their grandkids and they're going through this. I want you to know that even though that when your ground is shaken, I can show you how to find that strength that I found to pull myself up and to allow you to get your head around those things that you're struggling with, give you those tools to be able to handle that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a lot. One of the first things that I felt like I want to say, and I don't want this to come off, you know, obtuse or whatever, but, hearing some sort of responsibility, you know, with what happened with your son, you know, and the abuses that both of them went through. I mean, you know, there's one thing that I get out of this is, I don't know, we can fully take responsibility when somebody abuses our children, right? I mean, I think there's some in there, right? But at the end of the day, you know, I hope that some part of you knows that, that they got abused and that you didn't mess up on anything, right? Like, yeah, I mean, you know,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that is a hard thing to do, because a lot of parents, that's one of the things we're going to like, what did I do wrong? And for me, because I had already been through that myself, that was where I beat myself up, because I was going like, how did I not see the signs? Because mm-hmm. I knew the signs, but I didn't see it. And mm-hmm. I still didn't see it as he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. Because I think we want to, as much as I hate to say it, but we really want to wrap our kids in a protective bubble wrap sometimes. And we really don't want to see some of the things that they're going through and really seeing it and opening our eyes. And that's another thing that I want, because that's a good point. Because we're not, when our kids get abused, and unfortunately, it's a high number. Mm-hmm. And you're not always going to know. You know, we're not, as much as we want to be the type of parent where we know where our kids are at 24/7, when you are trusting in a small little neighborhood like we lived in, and we knew the neighbors, we knew all the kids that they played with. So we would let them go play and we would let them be kids. Not in our wildest minds did we ever think something like this would happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, as parents, we need to have a wake up call, because it's not just what you see on the registry. And by the way, there's actually a 7-year-old on the registry, which is another topic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to show a confused face right there about putting a 7-year-old on a sex offender registry.
There is.
You know,
the youngest one on there.
Yeah, that would be another topic for a discussion, but I'm not seeing the sense in something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at that we both are. Well, I've had several survivors of molestation and sexual abuse on the show, and I would say about 50-50, men and women both. And I think the universal experience that they've all shared, you know, very candidly and very vulnerably on this program, has been that nobody knew, you know, with the exception of maybe one where they actually like had a huge litigation and went to court. And of course, that was a complete and abject failure, you know, kind of in the same ways here, about how that's handled when children are victims of to adults. But then in your situation, it's like a, you know, it's a child on child situation, which is completely different, you know. But for the most part, you know, when these people finally revealed the story of their abuse, it was years, and some of them were even in their adulthood before anybody in their family ever knew and never saw. So I don't know how many families I don't have statistics. I don't have a study on there, but I really don't know how many parents actually, like, somehow spidey sense detect that there's abuse going on, you know, fast. I mean, I think it's sad, you know, between abusers and also just children in their confusion of not knowing, you know, it might feel wrong, but I don't understand. And I, you know, and especially if it's at the hands of another child, like, I mean, how do you know the difference? I mean, I can think of, I can think of a story of two kids that were like 5 years old each playing doctor. I mean, we grew up, we're Gen X. We've heard the stories about kids playing doctor with each other, right? And so then you're like, well, that seems like that's like a normal, I mean, I'll air quote normal around this, but like, is that a normal rite of passage for kids to become sexually inquisitive? And then when does it go from just kids actually mutually doing weird stuff to each other to actually becoming abused? You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah. And I question that, because that was my first question. I was going to like, well, maybe they're just all being curious. And unfortunately it wasn't.
Yeah. And depending on the child, of course, too. I mean, like, again, you know, power, control, suppression, fear, you know, all those things involved in what happened in there. And, you know, and for your sons to go through that at a young age, and with it being from a 12-year-old, and I agree with you, like, there's a story of suffering that's in there too, you know, that, for that poor young man, did you ever figure out, like, was he a victim of abuse as well?
We never did figure out. The mom went and talked to us, and I honestly don't blame her, because what are you going to say? And, you know, the DA really wouldn't say anything either way either, but it was just at that point, I was going to like, something happened to this kid, because normally it's fine if they're curious, because I raised three boys, so they are naturally curious about certain things, and it's just one of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, of course, the protection of minors, you know, is in here too, you know, as well. And, but here, like you mentioned, you know, the stigma that we have around, you know, sex-based crimes, you know, molestation. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that some of the episodes that I do, that I talk about this, and I've talked about, you know, mothers that molest their sons, which is also an extremely taboo topic. Yeah. It's just, there is this high level of discomfort with this. And so when you talk about being the mom of a child who then, you know, is accused of a sex crime, like child pornography and downloading child pornography, I get that. I get that whole the whole heartache that comes from your child, you know, and then the backlash. And then what do? We just don't talk about our problem. We don't talk about what's going on. And then guess what? Then yeah. we have abusers hiding in plain sight out of the fear of us being able to, you know, to raise this awareness and to address the help that people need, you know, in this whole area and stuff. Yeah. So,
and there's quite a few of them right now. I'm going to throw a stat out there because I am part of WAR, which is Women Against the Registry. And what we're working on is making it to where, yes, the registry is still going to be there, but there are 950,000 people on there right now, men, women, and children. Some of them have every single right to be on there. So I'm going to say that outright. Some of them, not so much. And until we in this country realize that we need to start taking that $80 billion out of the prison pipeline and start putting it into mental health to where we can start helping these people. These people aren't doing this for funsies, okay? They're broke. A broken person is the only type of person that is going to do this. And there's a very small percentage that's on that registry where those people weren't abused. And it's extremely small. The rest has been abused in some form or fashion. So why aren't we ringing the alarm bells, which is what I'm doing now? Why aren't we ringing the alarm bells and saying, hey, what about our mental health? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that in the 1950s, if you were a woman and if you actually thought for yourself that you were put in a mental institution. And I'm going like, here we are, we're thinking for ourselves. A lot of us are really, really strong women. And we are still struggling with mental health as a nation as a whole. Mm-hmm. Why are we continuing to struggle with that? Why aren't we putting the funds in helping people doing like Denmark does? Denmark actually takes their people that are struggling and they put them in a five-year program. They don't put them directly in prison. They put them in a five-year program to help them get their mental health straight before they even start thinking about prison. So why aren't we doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's complicated. I know one of my other guests, Fritzi Hortzman, is part of the Compassion Prison Project. And I had her on over a year ago. I think it was pre-pandemic, maybe even when she was on the show. And, you know, and she addresses the same thing, that if you actually look at the statistics of the prisoners, the ACE score on all of them are just incredibly high. Yeah. And, we've heard the saying that hurt people hurt people. Yes. And the challenge, you know, with the, there is a very strong part of our population that have been raised and grown up with a very authoritative, you know, style of relationship, you know, a relationship with our parents, what parents and how they should relate to their children and how they should relate to one another if they're in a power or, you know, position over them, that it's all about punishment and authority and direction and dictatorial. And there isn't a lot of room, you know, in that type of a style of engagement with one another. I mean, it's very black or white. You did wrong, you punish, you bought, you know, and that's it. And I would say, you know, when you look at the dynamics in the United States, that's probably somewhere around 50% of the population. You know, I mean, just when you watch behaviors and you watch the way people lean and the way they engage in dialogue with each other. And so when you have that idea that, you know, there's a cause and effect, which yes, that happens in nature. And like you've talked about with your son, like there is a consequence when you break a law. I'm all about that. I get all that too. Yeah. But I know like with Fritzi and with these other programs are out there is like, okay, but how do you do that and rehabilitate, you know, so that it isn't just this indefinite, you know, throw them in a hole and throw away the key, especially when there's a disproportionate amount, you know, again, the racism that exists in the prison systems as well, mm-hmm. you know, and that, you know, is a whole nother injustice on top of, you know, the lack of the mental health treatment, you know, of the people that can be rehabilitated. But, you know, there is that balance, you know, how do you, how are you able to rehabilitate a person, reintroduce them back into culture, allow them to be able to start over and not do a disjustice to the victims of the crimes, you know, that were committed and stuff like that. And I, there's no easy answer to that, right?
Like, no. And, you know, as being a victim myself, and it's just like, and a lot of us that are in this fight, we have been victims of our, you know, of ourselves for this. And it's just like, we understand from the victim point of view, but I also understand learning how to look at people and look at it on a case by case basis, because we do have the studies out there right now for that type of offense. The recidivism rate is like less than 3%. And when we're talking about that, you have a recidivism rate a whole lot higher for, unfortunately, that people are in there for drug addiction. And we're finally, as a nation, addressing that. Mm-hmm. And so we need to really start digging deep. And yeah, it's a complex problem. There's not an easy answer. And I don't think there's ever going to be an easy answer. But I think the start of it and how to help these people and how to help these families, because not only is the person that has committed this offense, the family serves time with these people. I serve time with my son. When he comes home for parole, I will be serving parole with him. And a lot of people don't realize that. And they're going like, well, you know, he did his thing, you know, just let it go. And I was going like, you can't. Because if he doesn't come home to us and he has to go to a halfway house, they're spending over $1,200 a month in to be at that halfway house. If when that type of offense is there, then you're also paying for the parole officer. You're paying for the GPS monitor. You're paying for all of these things. And companies thought that they were doing the right thing when we put all of these acts in here to do background checks, which is a good thing. But it also hampers those that are coming out of the system to be able to be a productive citizen in the society. And that's what leads them to go back. Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to give them the tools to where they don't have to go back. And part of giving those tools is me giving the tools to the parents so that they can pass that down to their kids when they come out of prison. Because I don't want it just to be for the moms and dads. I want them to use those tools that I'm going to give them, and they keep passing those tools on, because that's going to be the only way that we're going to break those generational patterns. That's going to be the only way that we're going to break the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, again, here's some of the things that, you know, pop into my head. I'm, you know, listening to you and having this conversation with you. And then at the same time, I'm, you know, my brain is also, you know, this is probably my, one of my trauma survival skills, right? You know, hear what the other person's going to have to say, what's the argument going to be, right? Like that's how we, some of us learn to survive, is I'm going to predict what's going to happen next. And then I'm going to, you know, counteract that before it gets to be a problem. And when we talk about something like, you know, sexual abuse of children and trafficking of children and, you know, all that stuff, I mean, it's a horrible thing. And I know we're focusing on your relationship and your son and, you know, what he did. And then we also have to acknowledge that in that mix are victims, the children themselves. Oh, yeah. And that's why it's treated so strongly, because really the point is to get to the people that entrap and abuse children to profit from, and all the disgusting and ugly things with it, right?
Yeah.
And so in my head, I'm sitting like, yes, we can be completely disgusted by what happened and that whole thing, and at the same time, try to build an understanding of how people end up in a place where that's what they choose to do or, you know, elect to participate in. Yeah. And right now we tend to just be hugely disgusted and fuck everybody, you know, like screw those guys, and not have a willingness to address it, which is how we continue, honestly, to keep it perpetuated. Because as long as we just, we don't have capacity and space to heal the people, to keep them from becoming, to heal the children that are victimized and the people that were the perpetrators and everybody in there, it just cycles in because we just keep hitting replay. You know,
we
this is gross. This is disgusting. Go to prison. This is gross. This is disgusting. And you're never, you know, you're never getting on top of it, which is really the conversation that we're trying to have here today. And the point that we're trying to make, we're not validating what your son did or anybody else. We're not ignoring the victims, the small children that were victims that are, you know, photographed and videoed. And I mean, God, and I've met people in this work too, that have been those kids that grew up into adults. Ugh. Like
it
my life was easy compared to that. Like I'm going to be the first person to say that. And none of that no longer exists in this conversation. No. Yeah.
No. And you're right. Cause it's, I had to think about that because I was one of those kids and I'm going like, well, how do you balance it? And that is a hard thing to balance because you're going like it's kids. And it's just like, unfortunately, we have to start somewhere. And we've got to break that cycle because I don't want another kid go through what I went through. I don't want another kid to go what my sons and that neighborhood boy went through. Because my heart still continuously breaks for those kids. And we have to fix it. And we can't fix it until we start really sit down and start talking about the problem and finding the root cause and fixing that root cause.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, you know, if you want to use statistics, anybody that's listening here, if you were to just measure the guests that I've had on this show that have admitted to being molested growing up and sexually abused, and no one knew about it until they were much older, either because they were trying to kill themselves or whatever, then what we do know is that there's a lot of it going on and no one is actually going to jail for it. No one is getting help for it. No one's getting any kind of services for it. You know, the ones that we end up being able to, you know, put in the prison system or, you know, whatever, you know, let's put the punishments on there, are probably in small comparison to the amount of it that's going on. So there is a huge problem, you know, that's out there that's unaddressed. And like you said, and, you know, obviously this is where, you know, my belief system is that it's about mental health and it's about being able to get resources into the hands of people at every different stage, you know, from the parents of the small children to the children themselves, to the people that are in it because they don't know how to get out. I mean, I just think about your son. Your son was a victim and he never figured out how to exorcise himself from that experience.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I'm not justifying what he did, but can I understand that the inclination to go for child pornography was because he was still reliving this whole thing that he just didn't know how to detach himself from and heal from? Yeah. I could see that. Do I agree with it? Would I do that? No, but can I understand that would be? Yeah. Well, damn, God, that sucks. You know,
and it does. And that's what we're fighting for. And that's why I want to help these parents, because we need to be able to break that. And the more people that we can get educated to look at some of those signs and realize when your child's behavior starts changing, that's when you need to start questioning things.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing there. So, I mean, let's just talk about that. I'm sorry to cut you off, but like you're getting ready to talk something. So let's talk about that. Now that you have a crystal ball and you can go back in time, what didn't you pick up on that you wish you had of now that you knew what was actually going on?
Skipping school. That was number one. And then plus the number one sign for him was he was constantly sick. Now, all three of my boys were relatively healthy. They never got sick, ever. But he was continuously, Mama, I don't feel good. My stomach hurts. I'm sick. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those signs that I really wish I would have picked up on, because it had gotten so bad that I would be late for work because I'd make sure that he would get on the bus. He would have the bus driver drop him off at another stop, which they're not supposed to, but he would get off the bus and go back home. just so that he did not have to face this kid at school.
His abuser. Yeah. Yeah. And that's understandable, right?
And then the next sign is, as he got older, he was extremely, my child's extremely intelligent in certain ways. And he had figured out that if he would just go in the door at school and then right back out the other side, nobody would do a thing. So he was skipping school. He was drinking. I found a full case of beer behind his bed at the age of 13. That really should have been an alarm, but I was going like, oh, he's
just a teenager experimenting. Yeah, totally. Right. Yeah.
And the anger issues. He was so, so angry. So angry. And that's really, when I look in hindsight, I really wish I had to sit down and said, okay, you have some anger issues. If you don't want to talk to me, can you please go talk to somebody? And if I had to bottle it up and put it in a package, I would say anxiety, skipping school, drinking, and anger. Mm-hmm. And of course, smoking the pot. Mm-hmm. And he even admitted, he said, that's why I drank and that's why I smoked. Because mm-hmm. he didn't know how to deal with those emotions. So if your child starts down that path to where your child was a happy-go-lucky child, and then all of a sudden they get silent and quiet on you, it's more than just being a preteen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sudden change. And I mean, and that's pretty, you know, when we talk about like warning signs, you know, kids do gradually, you know, kind of evolve and get into, and they do experiment with things like, you know, yeah. weed and alcohol and stuff like that. But the sudden, you know, instant change, you know, in personality can be a real signal. Now, you said that when you found out your boys had been molested, that they went through counseling, but what did that actually look like for them? Was it just like a couple of sessions to say, hey, you know, chin up, you'll survive this. And then they went on. I mean, you know, how did that actually go? Because it doesn't sound like it stuck, you know? No,
it didn't stick. And they really went and talked to the counselor. They went and opened up to him. And I do have to say that the counselors that they seen were wonderful, at least, you know, in my perspective as a parent, because they did try to get them to talk. But that's another thing with mental health. If you don't have really good insurance, or if you don't have the funds to continue to pay for that, it stops. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think that is something that should have continued on for a year. It only lasted, I think, like 3 months. That's not near enough time.
No,
not,
I mean, it wouldn't even
to scratch it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I just thinking about kids in general, because even as we grow, anytime any of us go through trauma, our relationship with it can change as we grow and get a little bit older. And then something else happens in life and it can end up re-triggering it and re-traumatizing it and reminding us of it and bringing it all back as if it just happened like 10 minutes ago. And so, for kids that have been, you know, abused and molested like that, and I mean, and just in general, abuse in general, and just, you know, throwing 3 months at it and moving on. I mean, no. And I'm certain, you know, your son's 25, 26 years old. You're not sure yet, but we'll figure it out.
I was gonna say, he'll get me sooner or later.
Yeah. But, you know, being like 8 years old, I mean, our vast understanding of treating children has changed in terms of, you know, I mean, the DSM, you know, was just altered just in the last several years to actually address the differences in post-traumatic stress disorder for children versus adults, noticing that some of the behavioral problems, like you pointed out, are actually signs of PTSD in children, you know, and the nightmares on top of that, like you mentioned nightmares, like that was one of my big hallmark signs was, you know, nightmares over and over and over and over again that kept me, you know, it just, you know, in turmoil. And so, you know, so again, we also always, you know, we didn't know what we didn't know. So, you know, can't really say there was a complete failure of the system. It was just based on the running knowledge that we had at that time. And now that we're, you know, fast forward 17 years into the future going, that wasn't enough. And we should make sure that the kids today are getting more than what we thought was enough 20 years ago, because it's not enough, right?
No, it isn't. And that's one of the things that I push for, to let parents know that even if your child has a short session of help, of counseling, keep pushing to get them more. Even if it's just talking to the school counselor, use those resources. But even the school counselors at that point didn't know how to handle. And I was one of those parents that was up there and I was going like, I need help. I was actively asking for help and they didn't know how to help. They had no clue. And I was extremely angry with the school system at that point because I was going like, those are the people that I thought would help. But now the more that I grow into this, they didn't have the tools and the resources to help either.
Yeah.
So it's getting all of us as a community to get those things in place for kids so that we are breaking that cycle, because until we do that, we're going to keep perpetuating what we see now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know, you know, this has been something that I've, you know, that I've talked about here too, which is trauma-informed schools. And, you know, the idea that like, it would be great if the school systems all became trauma-informed. And so there are some school districts that are, you know, readily integrating it into their program. But, you know, trauma-informed only works if everybody's truly trauma-informed. And not only just that, but they are actually working on their own shit. So, so you can be aware of trauma and then do nothing about it. And that doesn't make it that much better. You know, when you bring your own trauma into your, you know, into relationships with the children in your school, your coworkers, or, you know, whatever. And so, but it's better than not, you know, especially for kids, especially if in a trauma-informed school, you're actually asking all the right questions, which is what's going on, not, you know, Johnny over here is a bully, or, you know, that girl's just a, you know, snotty little kid and, you know, whatever. So I've had that experience too with school counselors. You know, my daughter had an episode where she had grabbed some pills in the middle of the night. This was in the early days of us kind of finding our way together. And when my kids started living with me full time, and it was a scare. We had a suicide scare. And so when the school counselor called me in to tell me about it, like in the middle of the day, I was, you know, I was drowning in emotions. And I remember sitting in this person's office and she like was the, like lacked any compassion. I mean, it was almost as if it was scolding. Like I had this feeling, I was sitting in this room, like, you know what? You're kind of a shitty mom. Your daughter got your pills. How do you think that actually happened? Like, you know, and so I just was like, we just got to go. And where we went was straight to an emergency room and to get a mental health evaluation and, you know, and figure out where we were going to go from there. But yeah, I mean, it's desperate when you're looking for help and you can't get the help and you want to do better, you know, and you want to try to find the right ways and the right resources and to have a lack of it. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, we do know that there's a lack of people in the industry to be able to support. So that's why trauma survivors like us, we end up picking up the mantle and taking on part of that.
Yes,
you know?
We do.
Yeah. And kids are, it's tough for kids to talk to their parents because they don't want the shame and the disappointment that they did something wrong. And that's something moms and dads, you know, sometimes why it's hard for our kids to talk to us is because they don't want our disapproval. And, you know, when as children, something bad happens, our little egocentric brains that are designed that way to try to process stuff, blame themselves. We blame ourselves for something that happened to us. And so we don't want mom and dad to know because we don't want them to be mad at us and disappointed with us. And it's a tragic part of the human experience, but it's a part of the human experience. And so kids do need different resources that they feel like they can, you know, open up and talk to and share or, you know, connect with. And so we can, as parents, blame ourselves if the kids don't come to us right away, because that can make us feel like shit for the rest of our lives too.
Yeah. And I always tell them, you know, go find somebody that you're willing to talk to. And even the young girls that I talk to now, and some of them that I talk at work, I'm going like, even if you don't want to talk to me, go find somebody that you're comfortable talking with. Let them know what's going on. Because until somebody knows, you're going to be suffering in silence. And then the next thing you know, that you're going to try to self-soothe and try to figure out why you're having these nightmares, why are you having these thoughts. And I'm not here to judge or condone or anything, because I'm the last person to do that. And until we get to that point to where we can let our kids know, hey, if you've got to go talk to grandma, grandpa, Aunt Susie, my aunts were the ones that I talked to. Those were I was more comfortable talking to them. then to my mom, and I loved my mom. She's been gone for a while now, but those were the people that I could talk to. So mm-hmm. those of you that are listening, if you have kids and you know that they're showing those signs, let them know, hey, I know that you don't want to talk to me right now about it, but can you please go talk to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
And let them know that resource, because then you're taking a weight off of their shoulder, because you're going to let them know, hey, whatever happened is not that bad, and you're not going to get mad at them. And I think that's another tip I want to give parents, is when you're going through that, you're going to be mad, you're going to be upset. And it's fine for your kids to see some of your emotions, but don't let them see the anger. Because when they see that anger, they're going to think it's directed towards them.
Mm-hmm. They do not know the difference. No. You really do. Little heads don't understand that. They just see mad mom and mad dad, and that's my fault.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we felt too. And I always want to remind that, like, we're talking about kids as if they're this separate entity from us, but sometimes our belief systems about ourselves are because things like that happened to us when we were children. And that's what we took away from it, that we did something wrong.
Yes.
You know, and we have to remember that, no, that's again, the unfortunate consequence of how our brain learns is to take take responsibility at a small age so we can figure it all out. So,
Because that's one of the things. I wasn't so great about not crying in front of them, but the angry piece, I saved that till when they were out of the house.
Yeah, go punch walls and beat up things. Yeah, for sure. Well, I know that you, when I was on your show this last time, and you were talking about a program that you've actually got. So you're providing coaching support in a program for mothers like you in situations. Now, are these just mothers that have children that have sex crimes, or just any mother that's dealing with a child in the prison system?
Any mother that has a child in the prison system. Or even if you don't have a child that's in the prison system, if you are going through anything rough in your life and you need to find that strength when your ground is shaking, this program is going to be for you. We're going to be diving into 4 weeks. And what we're going to be diving into, the first week is how to stand firm when your world is shaking. And what I want to do is I'm going to start in a foundation piece. And at each session, at the end of each session, we're going to do clearing work. So for those that don't know what clearing work is we're going to take everything that you learned during that session. And then I am going to lead you through a gentle meditation. And we're just going to let that stuff go. Now, this is not going to be a one or done program. Okay, this is something that you're going to continue to work on yourself for. And then week number two is going to be how to break the generational patterns. I am big on that, because until we break those, we won't be able to heal. We won't be able to heal ourselves or our kids. Third week is going to be building your foundation, because by the third week, you're going to have the tools that you need. You're going to have a lot of that clearing work done. And then you're going to be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And then week four, we're going to be talking about unlocking your future version of you. That is going to be your pillar or your foundation, because by then you're going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. You're going to have the tools that you're going to need, and you're going to be able to pass those tools down to your kids, because that's my whole point of doing this. Once somebody gives you tools, nobody can take them away from you. They're yours for life. And that's what I want to do for you, because nobody was there for me when I needed it. And I wanted to be there for you. And I want it to be heart-centered, because at the end of the day, it is all about a heart-led coaching program that is tailored to you and to your heart and to your things and to finding that strength, because mamas, you have more strength than you ever know. Trust me.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that you're doing that and you're offering that out there and being able to take, you know, again, the situation that you have, it's not one that you chose. It's probably not it's certainly not the life you ever would have picked out for yourself or anybody for that matter. But you're making something from it and being able to, you know, do some other things, some good things, and spreading that out for other people. That's why it was just like, it was a no-brainer to be able, after hearing a little bit more about what you're doing, like, Dang, Dawn, you need to be on my show. I want to introduce you to my people too. So yeah. I'm sure there's some of my people out there in my world that could definitely love to hook up with you and commune with you, you know, that can understand and stuff. So thank you so much for what you do and for being here today with me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it too, because I want all of you out there to know, because you're not alone. And that's the whole thing, is you're not alone and you're loved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.